Word of mouth.
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 This is Word of Mouth from New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Brady Carlson in for Virginia Prescott. Today, a network aficionado helps us explore the Internet's equivalent of a CB radio, plus technology's missing links, why the failed preambles and prototypes of our most beloved gadgets helped shape the tech industry's greatest achievements. But first, connecting the threads of the shadow web. Events in Egypt and Tunisia prove that although the Internet can't be destroyed per se, it can more or less be turned off. A fact that has some digital rights activists questioning the centralized, top-down organization of Internet service providers. Julian DeBell is a tech journalist and author of The Shadow Web, an article in the March issue of Scientific American outlining growing efforts to provide an alternative network that can't be powered down, and he joins us now to tell us more. Julian, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Good to be here, Brady. Thank you.
We think of the web as this very decentralized grassroots space, but as you noted in the article, it really hasn't worked out that way, and the Arab Spring is the prime example of that. How easy was it for the Mubarak regime to cut Egyptians off from the Internet?
Yeah, well, the records of network traffic suggest that it may have taken no more than 5 phone calls for the government to shut down pretty much the entire Internet in Egypt. In other words, the concentration of traffic in about 5 major ISPs there was so great that, you know, it between about midnight and 20 minutes after, you can watch the ISPs going down one after another like dominoes. Although, of course, it was probably direct calls from the government.
And how common is it that a country or a part of a country would have just a handful of Internet providers?
Egypt is a special case. I mean, in the U.S., there are a lot more providers. It would probably be, you know, harder for the U.S. government to pull something like that off. Nonetheless, among those providers, just, you know, most of the traffic is in the hands of, you know, top 5 or 10 ISPs. So it's a little more diffuse, but there's still a disturbing concentration of power within the big ISPs.
All right, enter then these mesh networks, as they're called, being set up by digital activists. How do they work, first of all, and how do they differ from that idea of the centralized ISP system that most of us subscribe to now?
Well, the way they work is exactly the way the Internet is supposed to work. I mean, we the origins of the Internet lie partly in Cold War attempts to come up with a network that could survive nuclear attack, right? So if some of the nodes got bombed out, you know, the other nodes could continue to pass traffic among themselves. And that just means that every network, besides receiving traffic and sending it out, can also pass on other nodes' traffic, so that everyone is participating in helping the network traffic flow.
Like you said, the Internet was essentially intended to work that way and be mesh networky. But how and why then did we end up being more centralized?
Well, because as the network built out from, it started out as at colleges and network institutions of higher learning and the Pentagon. As it went out and built out and became a consumer phenomenon, that was the way the economics of it fell out. That instead of each consumer also being a store and forward node on the network, you would hook up with a single Internet service provider that was doing the storing and forwarding for you. So that as consumers were added to the consumer Internet, it wasn't that they were creating new routes. That was the way it's supposed to work under the old mesh-style Internet. Every new node creates a new route, and therefore every time any node gets taken out, there are a number of routes that traffic can switch over to. As consumers were added under the ISP model, they weren't creating new routes. They were basically creating new cul-de-sacs.
And it just became easier for most consumers to just log on to AOL than it would be to Telnet into the local university or something like that. Well, let's assume for a moment that we did all decide we wanted to switch things up and get in on mesh networking. We couldn't just wake up one day and do that. Are the obstacles mostly technical or are they economic?
They're mostly economic in the sense of it just being a pain in the ass for users to set up mesh networks for themselves. Also, you know, they're economic in the sense of you need to find other people to connect with. The examples of functioning mesh networks now are these sort of do-it-yourself community things that have maybe 100 users or a couple hundred users. And, you know, you can't do it yourself. That's part of the problem.
We're talking about the shadow web, an internet network that bypasses typical providers in order to maintain an internet that can't be shut down, blocked, or filtered. Our guest is Julian DeBell, who wrote about the shadow web for Scientific American. In that article, Julian, Harvard Law Professor Jonathan Zittrain argues that from a public policy perspective, mesh networks are a no-brainer. Why do you think he says that?
Well, what he's arguing there is that mesh networks are a great option in public emergencies, you know, hurricanes and tornadoes and that kind of thing, and earthquakes. And in fact, you know, there is this whole community of mesh network hackers that have been working on building mesh networks for you know, about a decade. And up until very recently, a lot of their efforts were focused on setting up networks in you know, in hurricane emergency situations like after Katrina. And the idea there is that, you know, these kinds of networks are more robust, you know, just for all the reasons we've talked about, that they were designed to survive nuclear attacks, and they can certainly survive in, you know, emergency situations better than a more centralized infrastructure. So the idea there is that even though for governments it can be kind of awkward to permit these mesh networks because they're decentralized and therefore harder to censor and therefore harder to surveil, therefore harder to keep track of what criminals and terrorists are doing on them, it may also be very much in government's interest to promote them just so that there is a robust backup system in emergency situations.
So, and I think Zittrain uses the phrase poor man's internet to say it may not ever catch on fully with everybody, but it may wind up being the fail-safe.
Yeah, there are certain advantages to centralization, a lot of them having to do with the ability to speed up traffic. On the other hand, that's a downside, too, because that means the concentration of power in the hands of the ISPs allows them to speed up traffic preferentially for particular content providers that they may have partnerships with, and starts to get into censorship territory, even in Western democracies, you know, where we're not necessarily worried about government censorship, but we may be worried about the control of ISPs over the content that reaches us as consumers.
Julian, thanks so much for talking with us.
It's been my pleasure.
Julian DeBell is a tech journalist, author of Play Money, or How I Quit My Day Job and Made Millions Trading Virtual Loot. His recent article in Scientific American is called The Shadow Web. You can find a link at wordofmouthradio.org.